Christopher Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Is your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for San Jose Sharks fans trying to remember the last time they've seen a penalty shot in a conference finals playoff game. I'm trying to think about that as well, and I've not come up with one. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 3-hour tour begins right now, 6 minutes. 7 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to be with you today. I am the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Gorgeous day in the Central Valley. A lot of rain over the weekend. I was up in San Jose for most of the weekend, and a lot of rain up there, but just, nice to have some cooler temperatures. If I remember right, last year, last May, we were already getting into a lot of 90s, so I'll take this while we can get it. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, not a happy Sharks fan, Giants fan, Russ, keeping us moving in the right direction on the program today. In about 26, 27 minutes, we'll talk with Tony D. Lots of things to discuss with Mr. Diodato, the Warriors, Raptors, Bucks, maybe some Magic Johnson, definitely some Magic Johnson. You knew sooner or later. Sooner or later, it was going to come out. Remember when Magic... when he was announcing that he was stepping down, he was quitting the position of president of the Los Angeles Lakers in what was this impromptu news conference, him centered around a lot of reporters, and then in the back you heard Rachel Nichols kind of saying, really, you've not talked to Jeannie Buss yet? Remember that one? And at one point during that impromptu presser, you heard Magic say, I'm tired of the backstabbing. Talking behind my back and so on, and you wondered who he meant, and that's all come out now. You knew it was coming sooner or later, and we all pretty much had an idea of who he meant, and we could only hope to see a lot of this going back and forth in the press. We probably won't, especially the fact that the Lakers were introducing their new coach today, Frank Vogel. So Tony D at 3:35, 4:35, we will talk with Mr. Paul Leffler. I want you to get a dose of Fresno State baseball, talk a little RPI, and a legitimate, bottom line outlook for what we think is going to happen with this baseball team, because this Fresno State baseball team is playing really well. And you look at what I look at what they've done, and going back into a little bit earlier in the season, when they, for me, a couple of the spots that I look at with this team is when they went out to Knoxville, Tennessee to take on a team that is a top 25 team. And at the time they were 15-0. They hadn't lost. Fresno State lost the first two games, 8-3, 13-9, and then won the third game of that 10-7. And then as the season started rolling on, I just wanted to see how they would do against some other teams like Oregon in the Pac-12. They split that series when, in fact, they could have very easily won 3 of 4, if not all 4. And just moving forward, they've just been rolling over teams. I mean, rolling over teams. So coming up a little bit later this week, they will be in the Mountain West tournament, and they will play number 4-seeded Nevada. That'll be up in Reno. And they've already played Nevada this year, and they swept them 3 games. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there. So we'll talk with Paul about that. Top five at five. And then at the bottom of that hour, bottom of hour number three, we will check in with Nick Petruskevich from ESPN. He's a senior editor for ESPN.com. And he will give us the lowdown on what happened at the PGA Championship. You know, we are so prone to overreaction. And as you would imagine, with Tiger not making the cut, there was still talk of Tiger on Saturday and on Sunday, although most of the talk, as it should be, was centered around Brooks Koepka. But we'll talk about Koepka, we'll talk about Dustin Johnson, and we'll talk about the late run that he made. It looked like it was all but over, and then suddenly it wasn't. The last 45 minutes of the tournament really was the most interesting of the entire 4 days. And again, we'll talk about Tiger. We'll look at the U.S. Open coming up as well. Also, I want to thank Paul and Colleen. Paul and Colleen up at SAP Center, they grabbed some pictures of my daughter, my 12-year-old daughter, who made it onto the scoreboard at SAP Center. And I'll explain that in a bit, but I would not have gotten, I was just kind of in a trance as to what was going on with the mascot Sharky and just all kinds of stuff that was happening. It happened pretty fast, all cool stuff for a little girl who had never been to a professional sporting event, certainly not a hockey game. So I want to thank Paul and Colleen for taking some pictures of the scoreboard so I could actually bring those back. It was the unfortunate part of Sunday, of yesterday, for the San Jose Sharks is that they just played horribly. There were a number of different things that went on in that game. They lose 5-0 to the Blues. There were obviously injuries in the game, and that didn't help them. But you know, I always look for signs in games, and I'm going to say more often than not, when you see something a little odd happen or something that goes against you early on in the game, and I say this more often in football and hockey than the other two main sports, baseball and basketball, but. Right, I mean, the crowd is going crazy. It's a wonderful environment for hockey. I mean, SAP Center is just terrific. I mean, it is really one of the best places in the league to go see a game. And all of you who've been there, you understand that. It's a great arena because it's not like all of the newer ones that have been built in the past 5 to 8 years, 9 years, where there are just so many levels of luxury suites and club seats, and the roof is oftentimes arched way up there, and the noise just kind of drifts away. At SAP Center, again, you've got the lower deck, you've got luxury suites at the back of the lower deck, and then you have the upper deck that sits right on top of that, and then the other level of luxury suites are above those. So you're not pushing the place that high, and it's a flat roof. It's nothing arched. It's just a building that reproduces sound. The sound hits the roof and goes right down. And it is a lower roof than most arenas, at least you know in the – between the NBA and NHL, most share these. I've probably been in about 20 of them. Just off the top of my head, I know at least 20. And this is just one of the best places for that. But the crowd was excited. They were engaged. I saw the Associated Press report for the Sharks-Blues game, and they were calling the crowd subdued. I don't know. Maybe. You know, I haven't been to a lot of games. I haven't been to another game at SAP Center this year. But I haven't been to a lot of games up there, and the crowd seemed pretty loud. I mean, they were pretty engaged. We hit deafening pretty quickly in there. You know, when they did their usual light show and the ice, the projection on the ice of the Sharks, and you know the deal with the Shark getting lowered to the ice, and then opening faceoff, the crowd noise is just swelling, and it's getting to a crescendo, and then you get a rush up ice, 12 seconds. It was Evander Kane, wasn't it, who hit the post on that shot 12 seconds in? 12 seconds in, and it was reminiscent of Game 4 in St. Louis when the Blues scored 35 seconds in, and you got the idea that you know, maybe it wasn't going to be the Sharks' night. Turned out to be a great game, but still, they got that early jump, and that's what you want to do. You want to protect home ice. You want to get that early jump, and it looked like the perfect answer for the Sharks. Boom, rush up ice, 12 seconds in. They beat the goalie. They beat Pennington, and... Binnington, and then it hit the post. And it, you know, you heard that, oh, you know. But you felt in that moment, and it came back, that the air got just sort of sucked out of the building. All of the pregame excitement just got sucked right out of the building. Nevertheless, first five and a half minutes of that game, it was owned by the Sharks. The Sharks were taking the attack to the Blues. I mean, they were pressing. They were coming in. They were hitting. They were getting opportunities. And then first goal of the game goes to the Blues. And that really sucked the life out of the building, except for the Blues fans who were in there. It seemed like most of the Blues fans that were in the building were in the sections that were my section and the section to my right. But you end up with a 1-0 first period lead for the Blues. And again, it's frustrating. It's frustrating if you're a Sharks fan, because you're watching this game and you're thinking this game has this entire first period was controlled by the Sharks, only to see the Blues come out of it with a lead. And second period, that's when the second and third period the Blues really controlled the play. I mean, by the time the game was over, the statistics did not lie. I mean, 40-21 in shots on goal. The Sharks outhit. The Sharks were very aggressive, and especially as the game started to get chippy when the game got away from the Sharks. But you know what you didn't see in the second and third period, you didn't see the Sharks really able to get any kind of sustained pressure in the Blues zone. It was really unbelievable. And part of that is, you know, were some of the injuries that they had, guys that were not out there. But nevertheless, they just couldn't get any sustained pressure. They weren't winning faceoffs by and large, not when they really needed to. And then you had penalty minutes. I mean, you had, you know, if you include the game misconduct, which you have to, even the guy gets sent off, 36 minutes in penalties for the Sharks, 6 for St. Louis. The 6 for St. Louis, that included, or I should say the power play for St. Louis, that included 2 5-on-3 advantages and a penalty shot. And I'm trying to remember who it was that dragged down the Blues player. Do we remember who it was? It was Burns. Okay. And I mean, when a guy's coming in on your goalie, on a breakaway, you do what you have to do to try to give your team a chance to either stop a team on the power play or stop the penalty shot. Turns out they give him a penalty shot. I truly don't remember the last time that I saw in a playoff game of this magnitude where it's game 5 of a conference final series and a penalty shot was given. I'm not saying it was necessarily the wrong call, but it very easily could have been a hooking. And more often than not in playoff games, you will see referees lean, if at all possible, to a hooking. Did you think, Russ, did you think it was a clear penalty shot on that? It was kind of an iffy. Yeah, I thought it was 6-1, half dozen of the other. And I say this as somebody, yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I'm rooting for the Sharks, but it felt like it could have been a 2-minute penalty. It could have been 2 minutes for hooking. You know, he did everything he could, and then, you know, you had the penalty shot goal, which was just a laser. You know, Russ and I were talking about this before the game, where you normally see a guy come in, make a couple of one deke or a couple of dekes, and that's not what he did. Was that the Tarasenko goal, or was it the Schwartz goal? I'm trying to remember. I think it was Tarasenko. He came in, and he was coming in on the right side to Jones's left, and just fired a laser that went over his shoulder, and you know that was that. But I don't know. In the third period, if you probably read a lot of talking, you know, Peter DeBoer, we lost our composure, we weren't really ourselves, and he's right. And the game, as I said, the game got chippy, and the referees were just calling everything. They were calling everything. Again, another one of these plays where you had two penalties called on the Sharks on one play, where, you know, you see it's a delayed penalty call, and then before you know it, a second penalty is called on the same play. You had a slashing penalty. A slashing penalty and then an interference penalty, both on Evander Kane. Same play. And then Kane also got a 10-minute game misconduct on that, and that was all she wrote. 5-0 St. Louis Blues win. You don't see a lot of games like that. If you are a conspiracy theorist, you might be saying today, well, 36 minutes in penalties to six, was this an official, unofficial, or maybe I should reverse that, an unofficial official's response to the hand pass that led to the winning goal for the Sharks in Game 3? Listen, at the end of the day, you play with the hand that you're dealt, and the Sharks, as I said, the Sharks owned that first period. They played exceptionally well. They simply couldn't get the red light to go on. They had their chances early. They hit a post in the second period as well. That one, I mean, we all thought that was in, and then you look right down to the red light, wasn't in, and you had a game that pucks were just bouncing over Sharks' sticks. Pucks were just bouncing off a player's skate. You'd have a wide open net, goalie out of position, and all you need is to get your stick down and get it on the puck. Couldn't quite get there. It was that kind of a frustrating afternoon for the Sharks. So they go to St. Louis for Game 6 tomorrow, and if the injuries are, you know, what they are tomorrow, if we don't see, I mean, we haven't really heard it, Russ, we haven't heard anything about Pavelski. Right, and then there was Carlson. It's hard to say. I mean, you hear Coach DeBoer saying we've been here before, and they have, but I don't know that they've been here before coming off a 5-0 loss. But you know, listen, they won a game six, they won a game six in a tough building in Las Vegas, came back to San Jose to win a game seven. Meanwhile, Boston is relaxed, sitting and waiting. They will host whichever team plays. St. Louis hasn't been to the Stanley Cup Final since 1970. That is unbelievable. 1970. And do I think the Sharks can win? Yeah, I do. I do think they can win. But they've scored one goal in the last two games. And, considering how inept, I shouldn't say inept, they just weren't effective in Game 4 in St. Louis, I never imagined that they would come out and get shut out. But St. Louis played tough. Great forechecking game for them. I mean, they were all over the ice. It seemed like there were seven or eight Blues players on the ice the whole time. Rarely did you see the Sharks having very determined, definitive, smooth, crisp passing rushes up ice. If anything, they were getting met at the blue line. They were dumping in, and time and time again, the Blues were getting to the puck before the Sharks were. And as I said at the very top here, the Sharks were not. Able to sustain anything, even when they had a power play. You just didn't see much of anything in the way of sustained offensive pressure. So we will see what happens tomorrow night. Glad you're hanging out with us. It is the Monday CGP. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Tony D. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Well, as everybody in this building knows, and I try not to take too many personal moments on the program unless it's at my expense, meaning there's something that's happened that I'm the butt of a joke. But I will say this, and I really appreciate all the well wishes. For those of you moms and dads with kids and you've taken your son or your daughter, you remember the moment that you took them to their first professional sporting event, or maybe just sporting event. In my family's case, for my younger daughter, she's seen a lot of Fresno State Bulldogs games, and she's seen volleyball, but she's never been to a pro sporting event, and she's really just shown an interest in hockey. You know, she's a wonderful skater. You know, I should say wonderful. She's a good skater. You know, she played a little bit back in Fargo when we were there, but yesterday was her first chance to see a game, and I remember my first game was in Chicago Stadium when I was 7 years old. It's what I remember. Blackhawks and the Montreal Canadiens, and to see her face when she walked into the SAP Center, and I posted a little video on both Instagram and on Twitter, and on Facebook for that matter. It was really, really cool. I mean, it just, as a parent, you see the eyes light up, and just, I mean, the classic deer in the headlights look. But then, you know, nobody knew that we were there. I mean, Dan Rusinowski knew that we were there, but Dan didn't know where we were sitting. We were, you know, plenty of kids in the area, lots of families. It's a good crowd there. Good crowd at Sharks games. Sharky, mascot's coming up the aisle, and then walks into our aisle. And it didn't dawn on me that he was going to stop at my daughter's seat, but he did. And he kind of lifts her up, puts her on his lap, and she loves mascots. So now she's not only at her first game, but she's having a blast, and the cameraman's on the aisle, and then she's up on the scoreboard. Her face and everything's up on the scoreboard. And it was the kind of thing that, you just, as a parent, you dream about. And, you know, she's, you know, I'm having a steak sandwich, so she's having a steak sandwich. I didn't have a beer. I don't know. I just feel funny about doing that when I'm around her. But she's talking a little pregame video about she thinks Pavelski and Couture need to have a good game. And, I mean, there's nothing better. You know, when you take your kids to something for the first time, whether it's Disneyland, you know, or some other amusement park, or you take them on a trip somewhere, you know, it's a neat thing. And she, as we were leaving, she didn't even care. It didn't matter at all to her that they lost 5-0. She wanted them to win, and she was bummed out, but the event was the thing for her. The event was the thing. And as we were walking out of SAP Center, she said, so we're going to watch Game 6 Tuesday, right? And I said, yeah, heck yeah. We're definitely going to watch Game 6 on Tuesday. One interesting thing was kind of funny, and if you're from Missouri, I'm going to apologize in advance. There were, looking around the stadium, there were probably about 100 St. Louis Blues fans there, some obviously who live out there, who moved out there, but there were three at the end of the game, right before the end of the game, who were walking out. And a couple guys and a gal, and the one guy yells out. It was pretty quiet at that point, as you would imagine. And it was before the last face-off that they had, and he yells out, well, we all flew 2,000 miles to come to this dump to be here with you losers. That's what the Blues fan says. And the guy, a couple of rows in front of me, without missing a beat, loudly says, and your prize for that is you now have to go back to Missouri. And needless to say, that got a big cheer and what have you. And I don't know. When you're a visiting fan, you want to be happy. You want to enjoy the game, have a good time. I know whenever I've been a visiting fan in a stadium, I try to fly under the radar. I don't want to be the guy that's being obnoxious. That's not the way I am anyway in terms of being obnoxious fan. But, you know, you don't want to be the guy that upsets a whole section and people are tossing things at you. Whatever. You don't want to be that fan. But these three said that, and we hope their flight back to Missouri was a safe one. Game 6 tomorrow night in St. Louis, and it's do or die. If the Blues win, they go to their first Stanley Cup final in, oh my goodness, almost 50 years. Sharks win, they come back Thursday, Shark Tank, for a Game 7. Coming up, we're going to talk about this and much more. A lot of Warriors talk, a lot of NBA talk with our good friend Tony Diodato. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Well, in the category of maybe biting off more than I can chew, and by saying that, I'm also including, by association, my good friend Tony Diodato. I said on Twitter that up next, Tony D and I will attempt to solve all that's wrong with sports inside of the next hour. On cue, here he is, Tony D. How are you, my friend?
Overwhelmed, CG, but I appreciate your optimism. And I'm somewhat taken aback by it, but we'll give it a shot.
Well,
right? I thought we solved it. When we get back to an hour on Fridays, we'll be able to solve all the world's problems, right?
Well, you know, that I don't think we're going to get back to an hour on Friday ever, because what's going to happen is we're going to pick up some affiliate coverage of something going on like the World Bog Snorkeling League and in Europe, and then we're going to, you know, we're going to be down to like 8 minutes. So we come on, Russell, welcome us, and then we'll be out of here. We're done.
All I know is this Friday, because the Bulldogs are a lock to win on Thursday, we will have the full hour on Friday. That this is my complete and utter confidence about the occurrence in Reno on Thursday night. We'll see.
Well, they did sweep him earlier this year, so I'm. This being baseball, I have a hard time imagining that the crowd in Reno is going to play any factor at all, and Reno is going to suddenly be able to deal with the Dogs pitching.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think, Christopher, you're touching upon the fundamental issue, and that is you have a Wolfpack team that's getting healthy, and they are in their home field. They also were under 500 at 14-16 in the league, and because of that, I don't think you're going to see a huge home crowd. Matter of fact, our pal Gary just emailed me, and a number of other people have, that they are headed up for the tourney, and I have a hunch the Bulldogs are going to be more than represented by local folks, and I don't think it will feel like a home game for the Wolfpack. At least I hope not, because they don't really deserve it. If you're the one seed and they're the four, you really shouldn't have that home team feel for the four seed, but that's, you know, the venue deal, you know that.
Right, and these teams played 3 weeks ago, and I'll be talking with Paul Leffler about this in about an hour. I know that you talked with Paul a little bit earlier today, but, I mean, these teams played about 3 weeks ago, and, I mean, Nevada got outscored 21-6. I mean, these really weren't games. The first game was close, and that was it. I pay attention to baseball, but not nearly as much as football and basketball, but just I've watched this team more closely the past month or so. I'm just not seeing, Tony, where Nevada's going to suddenly turn this thing around and have some miraculous Mountain West tournament.
Yeah, we were talking last hour, as you referenced. I mean, the Bulldogs have in recent time, meaning during this month, have beaten these three teams, the three teams that are in contest with them, Nevada, UNLV, and San Diego State, 8-9. And you talked about the number of runs against Nevada at Pacoli Park start of May. They put 34 up last weekend and 3 against UNLV. So on paper, all three teams coming in, the Bulldogs are going to overmatch. But you also know baseball more than any other sport is not only reliant to who's on the mound, but also who happens to be calling balls and strikes and that funny bounce of the ball that can cost you a game, right? So you never take anything for granted. But I'll tell you this, if you were to ask Batesville and Company, how do you want a team to play? You can't ask for more than what you've seen from this team down the stretch. So hopefully it equates to a victory on Thursday and a title over the weekend.
No question. We're talking with our good friend Tony Diodato, as we always do every Monday at 3:35. Well, you have been far more accurate on this series, this Warriors-Blazers series, than I was. I felt that you felt a sweep. And Coach Q thinks that as well. I thought before the series started, I really felt like this series would go 7, and then at a minimum, I thought that the Blazers would split up there. But I'll tell you, losing that first game and having a couple of big leads and just seeing them go away, I think what you're seeing here, nobody, Tony, is going to question the difference in talent on this team, but I think you're seeing the difference in experience as well.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. The other thing is, you know, I was talking to Marcus about this. Earlier in the year, this was prior to the 30-plus point debacle that the Warriors handed to the Clippers at the start. But I'd made a comment to him, and Marcus is a longtime Warrior fan like I am, that with this Warrior team, no lead is safe in either direction. No lead is safe if the Warriors have it because they continue to play up-tempo, and particularly no deficit is insurmountable. You know, so much has been made, as you know, of the Chris Paul injury from last year, and I hope it was mitigated by what happened this year when the Warriors were without Durant and still beat them. But what people forgot about last year, CG, in Game 6 last year, Houston had a 17-point lead at the end of the first quarter at Oracle in Game 6, and the Warriors came back and beat them by like 40, all right? Houston had a 19-point lead at home in Game 7, and it got away. Well, the same thing happened to the Blazers. They had an 18-point lead the other night. They had a 13-point lead, 15-point lead, actually, second half at Oracle in Game 2. This is what this Warrior team does. And sometimes they drive you crazy because they give away leads, but they are just so much prone to that run that just no lead is safe against them. That's all there is to it. And Portland probably feels as though they should have a 2-1 lead in the series. In reality, they're on life support tonight.
Well, there's no question about it, and it's interesting because if you're the Blazers, whether you're on that team or the coaching staff, the organization, and certainly the fans, you have to be looking at this Warriors team that you've been facing, and you're seeing Bell playing 15 great minutes. You're seeing more specifically, guys like McKinney going out there and playing 21 solid minutes. Looney playing terrific. These guys together were plus 36 in their win the other night. And you have to be thinking, what do we have to do to beat this team? Iguodala was a little shaky. You know, there's no Kevin Durant, and yet they're still coming out and they're still beating us by 11 points. And it becomes a situation where the media spends more time talking about all the ways that sooner or later this is going to catch up to the Warriors. Meanwhile, the Warriors just keep doing one thing, Tony, winning.
That's true, although I will tell you what's interesting about tonight. Number one, I think the Blazers, particularly if Iguodala doesn't play, and I know that the MRI on the calf said there was no tear of the Achilles, but he's also questionable tonight. And I told you that all that stuff last year about Chris Paul, the Warriors were up 2-1, and it dominated Houston, including in Houston when Iguodala got hurt and was out for the rest of the series. And as Steve Kerr said, had he not been hurt, the Warriors probably would have won it in five. He's that important to the Warriors. If Iguodala is out tonight, it's going to make life a lot easier on Lillard. I know this. The city of Portland, and you know this well, loves the Blazers. They're not going to run away from them tonight emotionally.
Right.
I think that Portland has a shot to win tonight, but what I find interesting is Draymond Green saying the Warriors desperately want to get this over with because the series, the finals, will start on May 30th no matter what. But you know what? The last time the Warriors had a 9-day break was prior to the Western Conference final in 17, and that was the day they fell 23 back of the Spurs when Kawhi Leonard was hurt by Pachulia. The Warriors don't play well with long breaks, so I'm intrigued by whether it would be advantageous to get it over with tonight as Green wants to, or would you be better off going back to Oracle on Wednesday and maybe playing one more game. I just have a hunch that going on the road this year, because they're going to have to, as you know, for the finals, whether it's Toronto or Milwaukee, I don't know that 9 days off and then on the road is the best way to start a finals. So
it's a fair point, and it's also a good point that you're making about Portland and their love affair with the Blazers. I have equated it over the years. Curious what you think. I've equated the relationship that the Trail Blazers have with the Portland fans, the city of Portland, and really that whole region, similar to the Packers in Green Bay. Because it's one team. They've won a championship. Obviously not the championships that Green Bay's won. But irrespective of the MLS team there and Portland State and what have you, this is it. This is the game in town. And, I mean, going back to 77 with Walton and that team, this city loves their team, loves this team as much as anyone, and they will be as loud and as insane as if they were up 3-0.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, there's a palpable depression about being down 3-0, particularly because the feeling was they let game two get away, and then when they got up 18 the other night, I think they really felt like when Seth Curry hit the jumper to put them up 18, that this was their night, and then it gets away. But you're right. It's an apt comparison. The other thing is, and you know this, the dynamic of the geography there. When you had the Sonics up in Seattle, part of the Northwest was going toward the Sonics. The Warriors have always had their following in Portland because the Warriors were here before the Blazers became a team. But the minute that the Blazers won the title in 77, that they owned all parts of Oregon. With the Sonics now long since removed to OKC, they own that part of the Northwest. So it's become a regional deal, and they are, for Portland, the true major league club. They're kind of like what goes on with OKC, although Oklahoma City is a larger metropolitan area in a lot of ways for that part of the, you know, they're the DMZ, as we talk, between Oklahoma State and Oklahoma. That's a different dynamic,
yeah,
right, than Oregon and Oregon State and what Portland means to those two. That's because football is so important to the folks in Oklahoma. But I do think that what the Blazers do affects the psyche of the city. And I don't think they thought, after being swept out of the playoffs last year and then showing so well, that they would get swept this time. And there's part of me that kind of hopes they don't get swept tonight. I really feel for the folks in Portland. They're not going to win the series, but I think it would be nice for them to get one tonight.
Well, and I think that you look at, we're talking with our good friend Tony D. I think when you look at this this Portland team, they're a fun young team to watch. And you look at Lillard and McCollum and Cantor and others, and I mean, this is a team that certainly is a going to be a player in the future. And you just wonder, Tony, at least I do, this Golden State team, and you've certainly addressed this a number of times on this program, the Golden State team that we see right now is not going to be what Golden State looks like next year. At least we don't think so. I mean, stranger things have happened, but we don't think so. I don't think Kevin Durant's going to be here. I do think that everybody else will, but you know, more than likely Boogie Cousins is not going to be there, and it's almost like he's had a cup of coffee here, and then he's going to be out with a lot of. I don't think Clay's going anywhere, but you wonder if the Trailblazers are, and maybe even teams like the Houston Rockets, teams like the Clippers are thinking, if we could just last a little longer, keep this core together, Golden State's not going to be what they've been. We're going to finally be able to ascend to the throne, not because we beat them, but because we outlasted them and they broke apart.
You know, it's a great point and particularly relevant toward Portland because you're right. Lillard and McCollum are in their athletic prime. So your core backcourt has got a ton of years in front of it. The fact that Nurkic was out with an injury, even though Cantor has played serviceably well in the playoffs, not a good matchup with the Warriors because he gets caught out on the perimeter a lot. But when Nurkic was healthy, Portland was really viable, and Rodney Hood is playing well. They're a team, I think, more than any other in the West, because for the Rockets, they have to deal with the fact that Chris Paul is getting to his mid-30s now, much like the Lakers. No matter what they do in free agency, you have to deal with the reality that Father Time is undefeated,
right,
and LeBron is in his mid-30s. The Blazers can look at this and say, you know what you're saying, if we can stay healthy, the Warriors more than likely are going to lose Durant. And, you know, the more the media talks about how the Warriors don't need Durant, which I'm telling you is absolutely ridiculous, and there's no player on the team that thinks that, including Draymond. But it reinforces the insecurities of Durant, who I know, no matter how much support he's getting from the team privately, is thinking to himself, geez, this further the feeling that they don't need me here, okay? So if you assume Durant is going to New York or wherever he's going, and with Boogie, you're right, the only way Cousins comes back is that he's so damaged that he has no place else
right
to go, which is not good news for the Warriors anyway. The only way, Iguodala has been an amazing contributor for this team all the way back to the first title in 14-15. But I'm telling you right now, the Warrior front office is saying, CG, they need to bubble wrap, and this is no kidding. They need to hold Iguodala almost until March in order to have him for the playoffs. That's hardly a great way to have a guy ready for the rest of your playoff run every year, but that's the reality of his age and injury-prone that he is. Livingston, I think, has finally seen the wear and tear of the catastrophic injuries and coming out of high school to play, catch up to him. This is not going to be the same Warrior team. They'll re-sign Clay. They'll probably now re-sign Draymond. That'll be the core of three, and they'll have to piecemeal around him. They will not be the best team in basketball next year. They need to get it done now, and that means the throne is going to be vacated, whether it's this spring or in the fall. But it is going to be vacated, and I hate to say it, but that's the truth.
No, there's no question about it. And one thought about Bell, Jarepko, McKinney, and Looney. You know, you look at these guys, and you look what they had. If you just look at the box score, you see 6, 2, 5, and 8, respectively. But then you realize, collectively, they shot 10 for 14. These guys came in, who in this country watching basketball, how many media members, how many other people around the NBA would have thought that these guys would come in off the bench, and with the exception of Jarepko, I mean, the other three playing significant minutes, and not only significant minutes, but contributing, and they're all, you know, except for Jarepko, all plus numbers. I mean, they are, you could see the influence of playing on a team that has the kind of star power and veteran leadership that Golden State has. I can't say that any of these guys would be having this kind of effect on other teams, but on the Warriors, they have learned well and they fit right in.
Yeah, and you know, the great case in point, and you're 100% correct, is Jordan Bell, and we knew this when the Warriors stole him in the draft, because, you know, that was part of the deal of buying a pick again. Jordan Bell was, as you're well aware, the defensive player of the year in the Pac-12. His offensive game was roughly the length of his arm. That's the truth. He has improved that. He's got now a mid-range shot. But the biggest thing is, when he plays with the Warriors, and he did have his ups and downs, and there were some emotional issues and things that cost him playing time this year, he only needs to play defense, and he can do that and run the court. And even when he missed the dunk the other night, it was Draymond Green who said, don't worry about it. What happens 2 minutes later, he's throwing one down, right? He's a guy that has a specific role. Looney is a terrific player who's getting better and better. He's going to be a restricted free agent, and that's going to be a tricky deal in caponomics for the Warriors. Derebko's toward the end of his career. McKinney's a guy who is a jumping jack, who is a hot and cold shooter, but is always hustling, great offensive rebounder. And Quinn Cook has become a cold-blooded assassin out there. He's impervious to the pressure. These are guys, you're right, you put them somewhere else, and particularly when you put them all on the court together with, like, Klay Thompson, you go, this team can't possibly be the best team in basketball. Yet, somehow it works out. Is it going to work out against Milwaukee? I don't know. But I'll tell you this about Milwaukee. If the Warriors get this done, I think Durant will be back. If it's not the Achilles, if we really, you know, Stephen A. Smith's conspiracy theory, right, as Alan Jones kind of look at things, if it's not an Achilles, Durant will be back for the finals, and also an important cog, Damian Jones is getting playing time. And remember this, CG, he was the athletic center that was the starter at the start of this year and got that abdominal problem and that pectoral tear. He's been out the whole year. It makes a huge difference for the Warriors to have him back.
You know, you held that line up. You said Durant will be back, and I thought, is Tony going to say next year? I didn't know where you were going.
I'm going to tell you this. The calf strain is not going to keep him out.
No.
If it is a calf strain.
Right,
and
right.
I'm kidding around about Stephen A., but he, as you and I talked, went on that night and said, it's an Achilles and they're lying to us. That's what he said.
Barkley, too. Barkley said the same thing.
Those two bastions of journalism, how could they be wrong?
There's no way. We're talking with our good friend Tony D. We're going to talk a little bit more. I want to ask him about Draymond Green, and we're going to talk also about Magic Johnson. It was only a matter of time before the Magic Rehabilitation Tour came out with all the backstabbing comments and what have you, and backbiting. And finally, Magic has come out, and the target of the backbiting and, you know, the backstabbing, I should say, is pretty clear. We all sort of thought we knew who he was talking about, and now he's come out and said it. We'll talk with Tony about that coming up next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Well, I just want to... quick personal note again, personal note number two. I really like this song, by the way. Thanks to all the all our colleagues here at 940 ESPN for the well wishes on Twitter today and on Facebook. I really appreciate it. Genuinely moved and touched, and thanks for all the kind words. I really do appreciate that. Tony, the Draymond Green the other night, my goodness, 20 points, 13 rebounds, 12 of those defensively, 12 assists, you know, and then he comes out and says he wants to stop complaining now. He's done complaining, and he's done kicking people too. But when Draymond Green decides to play basketball and just play basketball, it is very easy to forget. I hear people all the time just ripping him, and we're going to have to continue this next hour, but I want to get a quick minute from you here. He is a damn good basketball player.
He's an outstanding player, and he is the one guy, CG, that, and this has nothing to do with the set two that he and Durant had in November, but he's the one guy who probably has his game most mitigated by the presence of Durant, because Draymond wants to be a point forward and a setup guy, and Durant is a guy, as opposed to Curry and Thompson, who basically says, just give me the ball and get out of the way. So if there's any guy that is able to flower more when Durant's out, it's Green. He's also a guy who'll tell you they need Durant back desperately to win a title. So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
No question about it. All right, coming up in the next hour, much more with our good friend Tony D. I do want to talk a little bit more about Draymond. A couple of thoughts about that. It's a good point that Tony is making, saying that Draymond understands to win an NBA title, you need to have Kevin Durant back. And this really has been so much of the hockey lower body injury. We're not going to really say what's going on. Not that I blame the Warriors. This is why hockey teams do that. They want to screw up your scouting report. They want to make it difficult planning and prepping for, you know, who you're going to be facing out on the ice. Same thing out on the court. More on Draymond and a lot about Magic Johnson. I can't wait to get into this with Tony, because some of the things that Magic has said, boy, he's not mincing words. And I guess Magic has decided, you know what? Y'all want to take shots at me? I'm gonna come back and say exactly what's on my mind, and he has definitely done that. More coming up in hour number two. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP, for a Monday afternoon, May 20th, 2019, begins right now, 5 minutes 40 seconds. Past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to have you aboard. Beautiful day here in the Central Valley. I hope it is equally beautiful wherever you happen to be. We're talking with our good friend Tony D. You know, Tony, you and I have spoken about this a number of times. When Magic came out and he talked about the backstabbing, he talked about being betrayed, and I think most of us had an inkling that he was talking about Rob Pelinka. He wasn't talking about Jeannie Buss or Kurt Rambis or anybody else. But nobody really knew for sure until he came out and would say it. And we knew that sooner or later Magic was going to say it. And boy, did he say it today. You heard some of the comments in the Sports Center update. I'll give you a little bit more for those who missed it. You've certainly heard it, Tony. I start hearing, Magic, you are not working hard enough. Magic's not in the office. People around the Lakers front office were telling me Rob, talking about Rob Pelinka, was saying things, and I didn't like those things being said behind my back, that I wasn't in the office enough. So I started getting calls from my friends outside of basketball saying those things now were said to them outside of basketball now, just not in the Lakers' office anymore. And then this was what he said was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was, I wanted to fire Luke Walton. I showed her, talk about Jeannie Buss, the things he did well and the things he didn't do well. I said, listen, we got to get a better coach. First day, well, let's think about it. Second day, okay, you can fire him. Then the next day, no, we should try to work it out. So we went back and forth like that. And then she brought Tim Harris into the meeting. Some of the guys, Tim wanted to keep him because he was friends with. And you get the idea. He starts to say Tim Harris should stay on his side of the building. Different people in the organization were going to different parts of the building. And it's very much what I said on this program last week. You've said it as well. Who is in charge in Los Angeles? And you'll hear a lot of Lakers Kool-Aid drinkers, Tony, coming out and saying, well, you're jumping the gun on this. Just give the Lakers some time. How much time do you want to give the Lakers? This is the Los Angeles Lakers. They have LeBron James. They have the second greatest history in the NBA. They should. The fact that they're not going to hire a president of basketball operations, the fact that they went out and hired Frank Vogel, the fact that they brought in Jason Kidd, there's so many things they've done here that don't make sense. If I'm Magic, I'm feeling pretty good that I got out of there.
I tell you what, except for his less than gracious way of handling things with LeBron, I agree with you. What I'm reminded of, CG, so much is what happened with the 49ers when the DeBartolo family bought the team back in the mid to late 70s, and Eddie DeBartolo Sr., of course, really the money behind the, you know, started the strip malls and all that stuff, right, and that's where the money came from, the family. he brought in Joe Thomas, who was a general manager for the Colts, and Joe Thomas had the scorched earth philosophy. He was just going to eviscerate everybody around him, and he took a team that was okay and just destroyed it. And after a couple of years of disaster, they brought Bill Walsh in, and the one thing that Eddie Jr. did was to give Bill Walsh full reign over the organization. And you and I have talked about this. Jesse Cipolla, who played for the 49ers, won the first four Super Bowls, said he came to the 49ers to play for the grandfatherly Bill Walsh. What he didn't know, he was more Darth Vader than he was grandfatherly, right? If you played poorly and you were a great player, he cut one of your friends. In other words, it was cold-blooded. It was better cut you a year early than a year late. It also ended up with an organization that won five Super Bowls. The last couple, of course, he wasn't there, but it was his structure. Jeannie Buss is the antithesis of that. She loves people personally, like Luke Walton, etc. Right or wrong, CG, you cannot run an organization like that. It has to be run as a business. It can't be, hey, I really like this guy, so he's okay. You can't have factions, and I think that Jeannie is a wonderful person and a smart person, but is hopelessly lost because of her own personal relationships within the confines, and that's what Magic was kind of saying.
And when Magic was asked, has anybody else backstabbed him, he made it very clear, Tony. I mean, you can't be clearer than this. Magic said, and I'm quoting again, just Rob. Other people didn't bother me. What happened was I wasn't having fun coming to work anymore, especially when I got to work beside, you know, knowing that you want my position. And so he's basically saying that Rob was, you know, Rob was the guy trying to get to the throne. Rob wanted him out of there. And I'm not sure. I get why a guy wants to come out, and especially even Magic Johnson, a guy whose basketball legacy will never be questioned, but his front office legacy, apparently this is a major concern that to him. And I must tell you, I'm a little surprised that he has come out guns blazing so much. What do you think's behind it? Do you think it's just because he wants to make sure that his side of the story is on the record and out for everybody to see? Or is it basically him saying, you know what, I put up with this garbage with you for the last couple of years, now I'm going to serve you up on a platter?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. One of the things I found interesting, and you just brought it up, he made it clear that Et tu, Brute only applied to Rob Pelinka, yet you brought up Harris. He said this was a business manager who was coming over to the basketball side. Okay, unless he was implying that Pelinka empowered Harris, he was also saying there was a power vacuum, that maybe Pelinka was the only backstabber, but he wasn't the only guy who was trying to grab his piece of the pie, right, as far as whatever power you might have. There were clearly power struggles on display. Even the Rambis situation with Linda and Kurt. The fact that Phil Jackson is still a de facto advisor, that's inevitable, right? I mean, and also sure. Magic made reference to the other brothers who wanted more of a say under their sister, for goodness sake. There are so many things going on that go beyond Pelinka, though it's apparent to me that the thing that Magic touched upon that kind of slid by, this is a Kobe Bryant guy, and I'm telling you, there is no love lost between Kobe Bryant and Magic Johnson. There hasn't been for a long time. Magic represents what he feels is the start of the dynasty, and he thought that Kobe was a guy who was at the end of the dynasty, and I don't think they see eye to eye. I don't think they ever have.
I think you're right, and it really is just the fact that we are endlessly seeing and hearing and reading Kobe references. There are those who believe that Kobe should come back and play, which is ridiculous. There are those who thought he should coach. There are those who thought that he should be the president of basketball operations. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just one thing after another. I realize, and I'm going to preface this about Jeannie Buss by saying, I realize this won't happen at least anytime soon. But do you think that if Jeannie Buss were to sell this franchise, which has been in her family for decades, do you think that's what they need for a franchise, Tony, that has the kind of prestige to it? Even though they haven't made the playoffs in a few years now, it's still the Lakers. They, you know, they still have that crowd. They still pack them in. Do you think selling the franchise would allow the organization, whatever new owner it was, to essentially clean house and not necessarily start from scratch, but start with new pieces who are established basketball men and or women, but not the people who are in place right now. Because right now this is, and I use this a lot, it's Shakespearean in terms of everybody coming at the king.
Well, yeah, and you know, I don't. It's a legitimate question, CG. I don't know. Again, with Jeannie Buss, she appears to be compromised because she has such great relationships. I mean, she loves Kobe. She loves Magic. These are two guys that I don't think see eye to eye. Pelinka is definitely, you know, the agent of Kobe Bryant all those years, definitely a Kobe guy. There's no question that Magic has his cadre of people around. I know this, that for Jeannie Buss, who won, as you're well aware, the power struggle with her brother,
right,
Jim, to get control, I think that the feeling that this would be, even though it was brought up today, they may be worth $5 billion, for goodness sake, the franchise. But what were you and I talking about last week? Why do you have guys that want to own NFL teams? There are a lot of billionaires, only 32, that own NFL teams. Same thing happens with the 30 in the NBA.
Yep.
You are somebody if you own a team. You're not just – Steve Ballmer was a billionaire before. He's now Steve Ballmer, who is famous because – you know, he's not Bill Gates' buddy anymore. He's the owner of the Clippers. Jeannie Buss, I think, is in a position where she would feel that it is the legacy of her father she would let down if she were to sell this team. And I think she will hang on to it doggedly because of Jerry Buss.
Oh,
and he's the reason the Lakers have been great for all these years.
I completely agree with you, Tony. And I think what you're saying cannot be overstated, because when you are an owner of a sports franchise, in particular this one, the Lakers, or an NFL franchise, you might be a billionaire. You might be able to do whatever you want to do and buy and sell a small country in South America. But when you are an NFL owner, an NBA owner, I mean, there is an ego situation involved here. And you are somebody. You are someone who, I mean, you are always in the public limelight, even though you may state publicly you don't like being that person. You still do. You still enjoy it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in that position. So then, given that we agree, and I think most people agree, that Jeannie Buss is not going to be selling this anytime soon, what do you think? Do you think the Lakers can move forward successfully and make prudent decisions come 6 p.m. on June 30th, because the free agent time is now moved back a little bit? I think it's a smart move. Can the Lakers make prudent moves? And I'm going to ask you a few things here, Tony. The other thing is, if they aren't, if the incredible happens, and I think a lot of us do think it would be incredible, if they aren't able to get a big-name, big-time marquee player to join LeBron, what does that do to the franchise going forward? I don't care who's on the sideline coaching them. If they don't have somebody with LeBron besides the Kyle Kuzmas and the Brandon Ingrams, with all due respect to them, that's a big problem for the organization.
It is the singularly greatest issue they have, and it's the one thing. There were two things about Magic's conversation today, and I agree with you. Most of it was defending his position and saying, you know, the slings and arrows have come my way, whether they've been public or not. They're going to all get out no matter what, right? So I'm going to go ahead and get my stuff out because you've heard rumblings. I'm going to clarify it. I'll tell you this about the Lakers. They should have been smart enough to know, since this was planned. Magic was coming on. It was promoted last week. They never should have had Vogel's press conference the same day that Magic did this.
Yeah.
It reminds me, John Miller said when he was named one of the A's announcers right out of City College of San Mateo, he said the same day Charlie Finley was firing managers and all he could tell us, he goes, oh, and by the way, after all this, here's our new announcer. You know, John Miller said, thanks a lot for that, right? There's no question that they should not have had the Vogel press conference today. But that having been said, there's two things about today that I was bothered by. One was Magic evaded the question about why he did not contact LeBron and kept coming back to, I had to do what was happy for me and made me happy. And that was not what was asked. It was asked independent of why you left, why did you not tell LeBron. He never gave a satisfactory answer to that, CG, in my opinion. He talked around it, right?
Yep.
But the biggest thing is, and this may be Magic being Magic, where everybody loved to play for Magic, play with Magic, you name it. His time as a coach wasn't great, but, you know, he still had a good relationship. He just felt like he couldn't get the players to do what he wanted, right? But it didn't mean they didn't love Magic. When he said today that he thinks the Lakers, his plan was clear cap space and it all be solved this summer because, and here was his line, LeBron will be in the room to recruit, and you don't realize how pervasive and persuasive that is. And I disagree with that. I think LeBron's presence is the great oppressor. I think he is, as we talked, the guy that is perceived by other superstars as, if it goes well, he gets the credit. If it goes poorly, it's your fault because you didn't win with the greatest player on earth next to you. That's the problem. It's not that LeBron is going to be there that's going to help you. I think it hinders you in signing the major free agents, and Magic didn't want to admit that.
You're right, and for those who haven't heard the comment, and this is where I think a lot of folks like Tony, like myself, are bothered or just have questions about it. And we should point out, and boy, I say this all the time, because I've gotten emails from people saying, okay, you as a Lakers fan, I'm not a Lakers fan. So everything I'm commenting about the Lakers, and Tony too, is purely from a basketball observer and somebody who loves the game of basketball, but is not looking at this through purple and gold colored glasses. The comments that Tony are talking about are when Magic said, I respect LeBron for what he just said, talking about, he would have appreciated a phone call. I love LeBron. I love his family. But sometimes as a man, you have to make decisions based on your well-being, and I made that decision. And the thing that I just don't understand about that, Tony, and in many ways, it's a lot like when somebody says, I don't mean to sound disrespectful, but, and then the next thing you say is disrespectful. And when somebody comes out and tries to pull the, oh, I love LeBron, I love his family, you know what? If you love LeBron the way you say you do, if you love his family the way you say you do, if you care for those people the way you say you do, then maybe just a simple phone call would have been in the mix here. But it seems as though both with Jeannie Buss and LeBron, he didn't want, I mean, I hate to say this about Magic Johnson, but he didn't have the spine to face them face to face and tell them what he was doing. He went in the back door, Tony.
Well, particularly when his rationale with Jeannie was he didn't want to be talked out of it. And I had the feeling that he was going to say the same thing, that I didn't want to tell LeBron because I didn't want to be talked out of it. Instead, as you just referenced, that was my issue. It wasn't what he said, but that wasn't the question that was proffered to him,
right,
as you know. Nothing in that answer said why he didn't contact LeBron. That said why he went ahead and decided to step down. It didn't say why, as LeBron said, call me up and tell me to kiss my you-know-what, whatever you want to say, but you got to tell me something, right? I mean, particularly because LeBron did come to L.A. for a variety of reasons, but I'm sure, and this is my guess, all right, if you want to talk about the conspiracy theory, okay, that there was a lot of conversation that Magic said to LeBron, listen, you bring yourself here, and I will get you your coach. You want to be Ty Lue, you got it, because I'm going to run this organization. And when Magic wasn't running the organization because of Pelinka and a lot of other people, he did not know how to explain to LeBron that you came here with one understanding, and now that is not applicable, and I'm Magic Johnson, and I'm supposed to be able to make this happen, and I can't. It doesn't mean Magic thought he wouldn't be able to do it. He just didn't have the gumption to say, you know what, LeBron, I got fooled too. I think that's part of the issue.
Do you think there was any chance, Tony, that, it's pure speculation, but why not? Do you think there was any chance that Magic's concern looking ahead was, if I talk to LeBron, LeBron and I already had our one-on-one to get him to come here. He was, it was only me in the house and LeBron in the house and a couple of cats. Do you think there was any chance at all that Magic's concern was LeBron was going to say, what do I need to do? What phone call do I need to make to ensure that you stay a part of this organization in your position? And Magic was going to say, I want Rob Pelinka out. And somehow one thing leads to another. Rob Pelinka is out, and then it comes back immediately that this had to be LeBron's doing.
Well, I'll tell you what, I think there were a lot of conversations again when Magic showed up at 9:01, right, on the doorstep when it was time to sign a free agent, that there were a lot of promises and a lot of things that were proffered that I really believe Magic felt he could do. And so my perception is that he didn't realize, even though he had been in the organization for a while, that Jeannie wasn't going to fully give him the keys to the car, and that he had basically presented that to LeBron in that regard, and then what you're saying in concert with that is the fact that LeBron has been hypersensitive to the feeling that he's been so Machiavellian behind the scenes, right? Isn't that what he took umbrage to in Cleveland?
There's no question.
And they were saying that he was really running the organization behind everybody's back, and he answered to nobody, including Dan Gilbert, the owner, and that he said, that is not true. I gave my input, but I stepped away. And then people said, well, you know, you're the most passive-aggressive guy on the planet. You clearly are doing one thing but not copping to it. So I think he was hypersensitive to that. I do think that Magic, much like he did with Jeannie, did not want to be talked out of it. I think he wanted to walk away. I don't think he's good with head-to-head conflict. Not a lot of people are. And I think the combination is you had personalities that just could not mix. And this goes with Jeannie and her conversations with Walton, her love of Kobe, which meant Pelinka, which meant Nick Harris was involved, with Magic saying, you promised me one thing, I'm not getting this, and LeBron saying, you promised me something, and I think Magic said, here's my solution, run, just run away,
yeah,
and let it go away, because I need everybody to love me, because that's always how it's been, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Well, you know, among many things, there's two things you can't outrun. One is karma, and the other is your shadow. And in this case, I don't think that Magic wasn't going to come out of this unscathed. And so it looked like when he did his impromptu presser, it was this is the best way I know how to cut my losses here and to make it look like I'm doing the best for the organization, even though you knew the other shoe was going to drop at some point. I've got a couple of more minutes coming up with Tony D. I do want to talk with him about the Raptors and the Bucks and Giannis and the whole gang, and is this thing going to go longer than we thought it was going to go? I don't think so still. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
More minutes with our good friend Tony Diodato. We lovingly call him Tony D. The Raptors Bucks series. I thought that the Bucks would win this thing in seven, and then I kind of changed my mind. I still think the Bucks are going to win. Changed my mind a little bit and thought, you know what? Maybe it's not going to go that far. I thought the amount of energy that the Raptors had to expend in figuring out how to beat the Bucks. I think there's this immediate overreaction again of, okay, we might be in for a seven-game series. I don't know that I saw anything, especially for the amount of if you want to use the word burden, that is on Kawhi relative to what you're getting in terms of defending Milwaukee, Tony. I don't know that I saw anything in the double overtime win for the Raptors that makes me think this is going to go seven games.
I agree with you. I'll be very surprised, pleasantly surprised, because I'd like to see the series go as long as possible to wear out whoever comes out of the East, because we've talked the East for the first time since the Warriors' run started here. The East is going to have home court because the 1 and 2 seeds overall belong to Milwaukee and Toronto, 1 and 2 seeds of the league. The Warriors were the 3 seed overall, the first in the West, of course. I think the bigger world issue from this, I think Milwaukee will win this series, and I have a hunch they're going to win it in five. I hope I'm wrong about that. But I think that this is reaffirming to Kawhi that there's no point in staying in Toronto, that the help that they hope to have around him just isn't there. Siakam almost disappeared the other night. Last night, you know, Lowry fouls out. Van Vliet's missing everything. If you're Kawhi, you're playing 50-plus minutes, you're already injured, I think you're saying, you know what, it's just a question of which team in L.A. I'm going to, and I think it's probably the Clippers. But I think the people in Toronto know that Kawhi, unless they find a way to win the title, Kawhi's done there.
And let's separate a couple of things here, because I agree with you, but I think what you're saying is what most of us agree with, but I think that's different also from what I think. I would love to see him stay there. I would love to see Kawhi stay in Toronto, because I think it's a neat thing to have a franchise north of the border with a passionate fan base. Their fans are as great as anybody in basketball.
I agree.
A wonderful sports town. And to see him there, I wish that they would put bodies around him, because I think he could create a legacy there to be one of the most famous athletes to ever play in a city that is obviously well known for a century for the or almost a century for the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know what I really have been overwhelmed by is here we have free agency coming up in the summer, and it may be, you know, when Cousins first signed with the Warriors, you know, the line was the summer was going to be more interesting than the regular season, right? It hasn't turned out to be that way. It's still a compelling playoff. But have you ever seen two more enigmatic figures than Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard? You cannot read these two on a bet.
Yeah.
You can't know what they're thinking all the time. These two guys are going to determine so much the future of the league, and I cannot get a read on either of them. Can you?
No, that's a great point. I've been unable, and I mean, you and I both know people certainly in and around the Warriors, whether it's media people or other people, and the people that I talk to, Tony, is like, your guess is as good as mine, man.
Depends on the day.
Yeah.
That's what I've been talking to people so close to KD who say, you know what? Don't be surprised if he doesn't sign one more one and off with the Warriors because he wants to play in the Chase Center because of the business opportunities in the Silicon Valley. Then others say, no, he's as good as gone. With Kawhi Leonard, I've heard there's no way in the world that he goes anywhere but L.A. Then other people say, you know what? Kawhi is just independent enough that he might decide the anonymity of playing in Toronto, even though you're playing for an entire country. That's still...
Yeah.
Anonymity as compared to being back home in Los Angeles. These are two guys that if you want to bet on what they're doing, good luck to you, because I have no idea.
And I last thing for you, I go back to this all the time with KD, Tony, and I know you and I have talked about it. I've talked about it individually, so have you. I can't for the life of me, on a certain level, understand why he'd want to leave a team that, like the Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, Bulls, and that three-peat, why you don't want to figure out, that was a different situation why they all broke up because of Jerry Krause.
That was management, yeah.
Yeah, that was
Michael
all...
really is intolerant,
oh, yeah.
By the way, of what's going on with Durant, because he said, if we had our druthers,
yeah.
We would have stayed together forever. You are voluntarily breaking
up.
No,
there's no question. I mean, I was in Chicago at the time. When Jerry Krause came out and said, I can't wait for us to see how we win championships after Michael's gone, that was it.
He found out.
Yeah, he sure did.
20 years,
there,
you don't.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of miserable locker rooms. But I look at KD, and yeah, Tony, I get it. I understand why he wants to have his own team, why something like the Knicks and playing in the world's most famous arena, I get it. But, man, you look at this Warriors team, and if they just structured everything and he played another year or two up there, who's going to beat him? Who's going to beat him?
We're back to, you know, you pay paradise, you put up a parking lot, right?
Yep.
You don't know what you got till it's gone. I mean, I think the reality of Kevin Durant is he is, and this may be part of growing up 7 feet tall when everybody else is 5 feet seven or whatever they are, right? I'm talking about it throughout his life.
Right.
He is obviously hypersensitive. That's the understatement of all time. Hypersensitive to criticism, and I guess he feels as though no matter what, I guess he really felt when he came to the Warriors that just winning titles would be vindication enough, and clearly that hasn't been the case. And I think he's a guy who, from the outside, me looking in at his life, I say, you have everything going for you, but you know this, CG, it's all about individual happiness, and clearly he's still chasing fulfillment in a way that it's hard for the rest of us to understand.
No, there's no question, and I'm right there at the top of the line with you, not understanding what it is exactly that he is chasing. Folks, he is Tony D, and he's probably ready to chase a cocktail after this hour with me.
I'm ready to chase the Moda Center in about 90 minutes.
There you go. Well, we're looking forward to that, and we'll see if the Warriors can bring this thing home tonight. My suspicion is now, if the Warriors get out to a good start, I really don't see Portland having a whole lot of incentive to win one for the Gipper, so to speak. I just don't see it happening.
We will see what happens. I know this. It's a thoroughly excited/depressed town,
yeah,
right now, so we'll see how it works
no
out.
Question.
A lot of Warrior jerseys around here, incidentally.
Now they're everywhere.
Take that for what it's worth.
They're also out in Nepal, too, but that's another story.
Not before about 2014 were they around.
That's
you're
a good
right
point.
About that.
That's a good point. Thank you, Tony.
Hey, my pleasure, CG. I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
All right, that sounds great. Coming up, we're going to talk some Fresno State Bulldogs baseball with our good friend and the voice of the Bulldogs, Paul Leffler. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
We're going to wait through the afternoon. Time for our Fresno State baseball fix. Nobody better to go to than our guy, the voice of the Bulldogs, Mr. Paul Leffler. Paul, how are you?
Christopher, I am fantastic. In honor of your 29th birthday, I am enjoying this beautiful afternoon, taking my dog Cookie for a walk. So if you hear her barking, she's singing you happy birthday.
I look forward to hearing that. We always appreciate that. Because last time I thought it was birds, and then I found out it was Cookie. And I actually, you know, I'm happy to report to you that I used to have season tickets for the Rangers at Madison Square Garden. And my buddy Joe, who sat next to me, his wife's name was Cookie. So now I've now there's a second Cookie, your dog Cookie and his wife Cookie. I'm not gonna mix the two up though.
Yeah, that would be bad.
So the Bulldogs finished 35-14 and won. When you started this baseball season, in all honesty, did you see them having this kind of a year, Paul?
You know, I had a lot of confidence that they would have a good year. You never know. But the thing that gave me confidence was senior leadership. You know, I have two local seniors, Zach Ashford and McCarthy Tatum, who could have gone on to pro ball last year, who said, you know, we want to come back to school because we want to win a Mountain West championship and go to the postseason. And now that dream looks like a reality in large part because of their leadership. Nolan Dempsey, part of that senior class, has been outstanding as well. You know, they have five seniors total. And the real difference, I think, has been made on the mound. And I think the fact that they played so many games away from home in really tough environments has helped those pitchers grow up where they perform under pressure with incredible success. And right now, I mean, they're just a juggernaut if you look at their last month and a half.
Well, you're right about that. Nolan Dempsey actually has been the only, of course, the CGP Bulldog of the Week every Tuesday at 5:25 p.m., and he's the only one who has been awarded that twice. He's had quite a year. I'm trying to see how I can frame this in the most respectful way to the baseball program. You know, I look at their team this year. I look at some of the games that they've played, and I'm looking at the out-of-conference games where they beat a ranked Cal State Fullerton team. They beat a ranked Tennessee team in Knoxville. At the time, the Vols were 15-0, and the Vols have really had, under Tony Vitello, a fantastic year. They went to Oregon. They split that series very easily, could have won 3 of 4, maybe even 4 of 4, but certainly 3 of 4. I look to non-conference opponents and try to see the relative strength of a team. How strong are they really? And when you look at them, Paul, take you're generally a very objective broadcaster as it is, even though obviously you're rooting for Fresno State. Take that hat off for a second. When you see them out of the conference, out of this tournament, how do they match up with top shelf talent across the nation?
Well, you know, their track record compares very favorably, not just in the head to heads, but if you compare what they've done down the stretch. And I think that's what's most impressive. You know, you look at 3 consecutive road sweeps in conference. Look around the country. See who else has done that. The list is pretty short. You'll see Stanford, Louisville, and Vanderbilt on that list. All 3 of those teams are in the top 10. Vanderbilt's the only team in the country with a longer road winning streak than Fresno State. And the toughest thing to do in college baseball is win on the road. It's even tougher to sweep on the road, especially in conference, and especially in this conference, where the home field advantage, I think, is heightened by altitude situations like they dealt with in Reno 3 weeks ago and they'll deal with again this week. They didn't have to go to Albuquerque this year. I think that's where it's craziest. But, you know, they've come through in some really challenging situations. They've been really consistent, and they've taken care of business on those, you know, midweek games as well on Tuesday and Wednesday nights, which has actually made a difference for them in the RPI department.
You mentioned it's tough to win on the road in this conference, and folks, if you haven't figured it out already, it's Paul Leffler, of course, voice of the Bulldogs. We're talking about Fresno State baseball. They will tee it up a little later this week. They're going to be playing the second game. It'll be game 2, and that'll be at 6:30 p.m. They'll be playing the number 4 seed Nevada in Reno, and they swept Nevada about 3 weeks ago or thereabouts, give or take a day. and two of the games were blowouts. There was one close game, but they played exceptionally well. I touched on this a little bit with Tony D earlier, but I did want to get your sense. In basketball, the phrase we always hear is it's very tough when the tournament comes around. It's very tough to beat a team for a third time around when they end up playing them in the conference tournament. Is there any crossover of that into baseball that you've seen over the years, Paul, where a team has success in the regular season, like Fresno State did with Nevada, and now they're going to play them in the Mountain West tournament? And is there any chance that you see that Nevada suddenly rising up?
Well, yeah. For one, they're on their home fields. And what a bonus for them, you know. And in a four-team tournament like that, I mean, it's the same story in a regional. If you're the four seed and you beat the one seed, you basically become the one seed. And Nevada has that opportunity on its home field. When the Dogs and Pack played 3 weeks ago, Nevada was missing arguably its two best hitters. One of them will be back for sure. Another one could be back. So that could be a difference. You know, who knows what the weather situation is. Altitude is a great equalizer for great pitching. And the Bulldogs have far and away the best and deepest pitching staff in the conference. I mean, they dominated on the mound this year in the Mountain West. They have, you know, by far the best team ERA. They have the best pitcher in Ryan Jensen, who I think could beat any team in the country on a given night, the way he's been pitching the last couple months. But sometimes altitude can equalize that. And if you need a recent example, go back to the 2016 tournament in Albuquerque. The Bulldogs are the regular season champs. They end up losing a heartbreaker in a down-to-the-wire game against Air Force, who had a first-round pitching in that game in Griffin Jacks. So they have to come back and play Nevada. And, you know, they end up getting eliminated by Nevada, a team that they had beaten every time during the regular season. So, yeah, these things do happen in conference tournaments. That's why I think Mike Batesel should be thankful his team has performed so well this year and has built an at-large resume for a bid. But, you know, let's be clear. The Bulldogs are a clear favorite. They're playing by far the best baseball in the Mountain West right now and really some of the best baseball in the country. That's no exaggeration if you look what they've done for the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel. At least maybe I'm just drawing it, or swinging at the wind here. But it's interesting that a couple of key players for Nevada were out during that three-game sweep from the Bulldogs. They're going to be back. And I'm just immediately thinking about football. When the Dogs went up there and they Nevada gave them all they could handle for a while and Ty Ganji was out. Just interesting how that happens sometimes, isn't it?
It is, and that happened a lot with football this year. But that doesn't take away from the fact that they showed up and got it done on those days. And I think that's what the great number of road games the Bulldogs played this year. I mean, they ended up playing more away from home than at home. That's the first time I have ever seen that. It's probably the first time in 40 years that that's happened with a Fresno State baseball schedule for the regular season. But I think the benefit is this team has been hardened by that adversity, by those tough situations they found themselves in, whether it be weather or a great opponent, or a call that doesn't go their way, or a bad bounce. They've learned how to handle that and move on and make their own breaks and control what they can control. And right now, that's what this team is doing. I mean, this is an aggressive and confident team with strength in the batting order from top to bottom. You know, two starters who are a combined 18-2 this year who have been lights out, third starter in Nico Mitchell who had one of his better performances Sunday, and a bullpen that has been incredible all year long. So, you know, what's missing in that equation? I guess we'll find out in Reno this week.
The thing that jumps out, you know, if you're looking at the Bulldogs from a distance, the thing that jumps out immediately is, and you've already touched on this, but I want to get a little deeper into it, is their offensive efficiency and productivity. I mean, they're scoring in double figures. They're hitting the ball out of the park. They're spraying it to all parts of the field. They're getting guys on base. They're getting guys home when they're on base. I mean, they're not only doing the big things, Paul, but they're doing all the little things as well.
They are, and I think that's been the biggest maturation in this team that we've seen over the last 6 or 7 weeks. Earlier in the year, they had chances to deal those knockout blows early in games, and they left a lot of guys at third base with less than two outs, you know, a cardinal sin for an offense, and they did that repeatedly. We haven't seen that lately. I mean, we've seen them go for the jugular. For instance, this weekend at UNLV, who, by the way, has a player in Bryson Stott who's going to be drafted before anybody else in the conference, who had a pitcher go on Friday night who came within one out of a no-hitter this year, and the Bulldogs pounded him. They put four runs on him in the first inning, and over those three games, they scored 10 first-inning runs. So this is a team that is jumping on people early, that is making that statement, hey, we're going to take it today, and you can try, but you're not going to get us. And that's the way they've been away from home for most of the year. I mean, you look at a 17-6 record in true road games, plus three neutral site wins, so 20-6 away from home. And, you know, a couple of those were games that could have gone their way as well. So they've been really, really, really impressive in those situations. And there's nothing that tells you that's going to change this week.
You and I have one more thing for you. You and I have, and you have plenty of time to roll out your answer because I'm very interested in hearing this. You and I have talked off the air about something that neither of us really care much for, and that's the RPI. And I'm going to use a comparison for softball, and follow me here for a moment. Fresno State softball team at the time had a 70 RPI. They finished in fourth above Boise State. They swept Boise State. They pounded Boise State in three games, 20-6. Boise State gets the nod. They go to the Gainesville Regional. And to be fair, Boise State played great out there. They got all the way to the championship Sunday, and the Gators shut them down. And the Bulldogs didn't fare as well in that national invitation tournament, but that's really not the issue. The issue is who should get taken and who doesn't. So rolling that, Paul, into Fresno State baseball, their current RPI, they're currently 36 in RPI. That would seem to be a near lock to get in, and yet we saw in softball, we saw a last place 28-25 team in Texas A&M with an RPI lower than San Jose State and UNLV make it to the NCAA tournament, and those teams did not. Do you see any conceivable way in a worst-case scenario up in Reno this weekend that Fresno State doesn't make the tournament?
Yeah, it's conceivable. I don't think it's likely. But, you know, there's a recent history. I mean, 4 years ago, Nevada had its best team ever and had more road wins than anybody in the country and had an RPI in the top 40. But in a rain-soaked tournament on its home field, went 0-2. And that was the excuse the committee needed. Oh, they're not ready for prime time. They don't get in. So this huge body of work they built up throughout the season, it didn't matter in the end. So, yeah, that's always a possibility. You know, if you're a power conference team and you have that RPI, you're good to go. But as a mid-major, a quote-unquote mid-major, there's no guarantee. Well, I think they're in a great position, and I certainly don't expect them to go 0-2. There's a pretty clear path for them to leave no doubt, and that's to do exactly what they've done every weekend for the last month and a half, which is go out there, set a tone in the first day of the series, and keep it going throughout the weekend. And there's nothing to suggest that that's going to change this weekend. They played, I think, their best series of the year this last weekend with the most on the line. And that game they played Friday night where they knew they could clinch a regular season title. I mean, Jensen came out and was just nails. They jumped on him with four in the first inning against the Rebels' best pitcher, and they just made a statement. And I think that's something that fans should buy into. And you asked me at the start, did I see this coming? I saw the potential for this. But it's this team that's made it happen. It's these senior leaders and a pitcher like Jensen who is so pivotal on the squad, who said, you know what, I'm going to handle whatever comes my way. I'm not going to let a bad break get in my way. I'm not going to let anything snowball. I'm going to control what I can control. And that's contagious. This team has trust. This team has chemistry. And this team has supreme confidence right now.
Well, you folks, you heard it right here from Paul Leffler. Paul will have the call on the games this weekend. You would like to think that Fresno State is in very good position to win a Mountain West tournament title. We shall see. I do think they're going to find their way into the NCAA tournament. The question is going to be really where and how well will their regional fit be depending upon what they do this weekend. Paul, my friend, it's always good to catch up with you. Saw you here in the station today. It's good seeing you in person. And we'll talk with you later this week, I'm sure.
All right, man. Have a great rest of your birthday.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. One more segment this hour. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Yeah, it didn't help the case that I was making for Fresno State softball, and we sure like Linda Garza and her team. They beat UC Riverside 18-10 in the National Invitational Softball Championship in the regional up in Reno, and then they lose to Nevada 8-3. They lose to Loyola Marymount 8-5. End of story. But as I told Paul, I don't think that is the whole story. You play to the level that you are seeing across the diamond, and I don't know. I don't think any of these teams were any better than Fresno State. But, hey, credit to Nevada and Loyola Marymount. They came out and they did what they had to do. They scored 16 runs on Bulldogs pitching. But the point here is there's too much emphasis given to RPI. That's why college basketball got rid of it and they went to the net system, because RPI has too many holes in it. Everyone, and I do mean everyone who follows the sport, understands that. And when you look at how ridiculous it was that the NCAA gave what amounted to a tournament history bid to Texas A&M, you know, getting them into the tournament at 28-25, last place in the SEC, and an RPI lower than San Jose State and UNLV, and just above Fresno State. It's ridiculous. That's why I'm curious to see what happens with Fresno State this weekend. Fresno State can just close the door on any discussion, any, you know, are they on the bubble or not, by just winning. Just go out and win the tournament, do what you've been doing all year, win it all, and then there's no discussion. But if they pick up a loss, or if they don't win the tournament, then you have to look at the fact that they're 36 in RPI, and that should be more than enough. Oh, we're going to keep our eyes on this. You can be sure of that. Coming up, top five at five. Later in the hour, Nick Petruskevich from ESPN. We're talking golf, PGA Championship, and looking ahead to the U.S. Open. Glad you're with us. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5 for a Monday afternoon. Most of these stories, I think you've heard in one form or another. Not all of them, but most of them. But we'll try to give you a little bit of a longer take, or maybe just a couple of other things that we held back earlier that we'll share with you right now.
Number one.
Interesting out of Pittsburgh, Ben Roethlisberger saying that he went too far in using his weekly radio show to criticize his former teammate Antonio Brown. That was back in the 2018 season. He had a lengthy sit-down interview with KDKA Television in Pittsburgh. It's going to run tonight. It's already run, actually. Their 6 o'clock news. It'll run on their 11 as well. Saying that it was just a connection that went wrong. And, you know, the more it went wrong, the more he doubled down on it. He said, I took some heat, and deservedly so, for some of the comments on that show, and especially toward him. I genuinely feel bad about that, and I'm sorry. Did I go too far after that Denver game? Probably. And, close quote. You should know these are the first comments that Roethlisberger has made in this offseason. In the whole aftermath of the Brown trade, it's been mostly Brown talking and people who are close to Brown, but Roethlisberger hasn't really said anything at all. And, you know, it's back in the season after week 12, he went on the Fan there in Pittsburgh, and he was a little bit contrite after, you know, he had come out. You remember he came out and he said that Brown should have run a flatter route on this late game interception. He wished he had thrown the ball to Juju Smith at the goal line instead. And you know, the thing is, when you allow something to go as long as this did, and I guess on a certain level you can say, does it really matter at this point? Is Ben Roethlisberger concerned about his relationship with Antonio Brown at this point? I don't think so. I don't know why he would be. Brown is in Oakland. They're not going to really cross paths until they're playing against one another, and they're not going to actually play against one another on the field at the same time. The only thing I can think of is that for whatever reason, Roethlisberger has had some sense of, or somebody told him that maybe you should come out and go the contrite route a little bit further and just you know, see how that plays, because you're taking a little bit of negative flack here, and we want to make sure that we kind of rectify that right now. So, you know, he says it ruined their friendship, and you talk to other people and you hear other people saying that, well, their friendship wasn't really great to begin with, that it had started to crumble over the last couple of years. But you know, it's, I think this seems to be a little bit too late.
number two.
Well, Freddie Kitchens coming out, and this is a touchy subject, and I mean a difficult one for them with the running back that they picked up, of course, Kareem Hunt, and they, Freddie Kitchens and the GM John Dorsey, they have consistently said that the Browns are going to support Kareem Hunt, not only as a football player going forward, but as a person. And they went to a, this is what they said at a golf tournament, and they went to came out and they said they're gonna support Kareem Hunt as he gets baptized. You know, which is great. I mean, they should do that. But I think, again, and maybe I'm too cynical. You know, he's getting baptized on Sunday. He's excited about that. He's excited that, you know, he's being supported by his coach, by his GM. But again, whenever I see this kind of stuff made public in terms of, well, this is happening in Kareem's life, and good for him that he's doing that, you know, if you are inclined to think that way, and I am. But I do wonder... I should say he was baptized this past Sunday, excuse me. But I do wonder sometimes, are you doing this fully to support Kareem Hunt, or are you doing it to put a different face on Kareem Hunt in terms of everything that has happened? Everything that has happened with Kareem Hunt, it's all very well documented. We're not going to relitigate it here. But I don't know that a lot of times teams, whether it's an owner, whether it's a coach, a general manager, a lot of times in situations like this, especially with someone who has been in some serious trouble, they sign him after the video comes out of Hunt shoving and kicking a woman at, you know, in his residence, and you know, neither have faced charges, but it was just, the whole thing was just a bad look all the way around. And you all know what happened after that. But I wonder sometimes if, you know, is it better to just go the quiet route, stay under the radar, support him privately, support him as much as possible, help him become a better person, and eventually, you know, if you're satisfied that he has become a better person, you're satisfied that he has done what he has needed to do to be the kind of individual that the organization can look at and say, we feel good about you being a part of the Cleveland Browns, being a part of us up in here in northeastern Ohio. Is it a better way to go quietly and support an individual that way, or is it better to do it this way? Is it better to come out? I'm a fan of going quiet, because when you go public like this and you're coming out and saying, see, we do support him, we went to his baptism, it starts to tell me that this is more about, we're trying to hit the PR trail here, we're trying to hit this early and often with Kareem Hunt, more than anything else. We're trying to essentially, you know, marinate the area into understanding that he's going to be a part of this team soon, and we want you to see what he's doing. And I'm the other way. I just, you know what? Support him. Do what you need to do. And then when the time comes, get back out in the open and say, here's what's gone on over the past 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, and so on.
Number three.
I'm not saying that they're not being legitimate, but there's an element of that, just an element of that, that to me, that seems a little bit duplicitous. We talked about the Blues and the Sharks a little bit earlier, and if you missed it over the weekend, of course, 5-0, the Blues dominate the Sharks. It was a game five that saw the Sharks come out and play exceptionally well in the first 5 minutes. Boy, when you're playing at home in the playoffs, it's really those first 5 to 8, 10 minutes that you really want to assert yourselves and dominate a game and get a lead of a couple goals if you can. And they came so close, 12 seconds in, and about 5:35, 5:40 of the first period, somewhere in that area, St. Louis struck first, and St. Louis never looked back. They dominated the last two periods. The game got very chippy. There was a huge penalty minutes imbalance, 36 minutes to 6. You had 2 5-on-3 advantages for the Blues. You had a penalty shot, which was kind of a 50-50 Maybe it should have been a penalty shot. Maybe it should have been hooking. Normally in the playoffs, normally, not always, but the vast majority of the time, referees try to err on a two-minute penalty versus giving a team a penalty shot because, you know, a penalty shot is almost scoring it up on the scoreboard. But that's not to say St. Louis didn't deserve the win. They absolutely did. They take a 3-2 series lead, and you know they've got to go back now, and they're playing at home, and they have a chance to wrap this series up and go to the first Stanley Cup that they have been to since 1970. And this is a team. This is a St. Louis Blues team. They were last. They were last in their in the standings on January 2nd. And, you know, I'd like to think that the Sharks can go back there and really play a magnificent game and steal one, much like they did. That game six in Vegas, am I remembering it right? That was a double overtime win, wasn't it? Or was it the same? I can't remember. I think it was an overtime or double overtime. I can't remember. Seems like it was forever, doesn't it? Forever ago. But, you know, the other thing I didn't understand I read all the different accounts of the game. And, I mean, I was there. I was in the arena. And the one thing that I didn't understand is the way the Associated Press framed the afternoon. They said that it was an afternoon contest, and I'm quoting, that led to a more subdued crowd than usual. I didn't think that at all. I mean, at the beginning of the game, you couldn't hear the person next to you. I know. My daughter was next to me, and I saw her lips moving. That's all I could hear or see. And the first 4.5, 5 minutes of the game, the crowd was completely into it. I mean, it was, people were absolutely engaged. But that first goal for St. Louis, yeah, that's when the air got let out of the building.
Number 4.
Well, Chris Long, 11 years in the National Football League, most recently the Philadelphia Eagles, is going to hang it up. He is the reigning Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year. Eagles put out a statement saying there aren't many players who can say they won back-to-back Super Bowls and the NFL's Walter Payton Man of the Year Award. There's no question that his work ethic combined with his unique talent made him into one of the greatest of this era's professional athletes. We're very thankful Chris chose to play for the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, this is a guy who, boy, you talk about somebody who looks well beyond his sport. This is him. This is a guy who won a Super Bowl with both the Eagles and the New England Patriots. He and his dad, Howie Long, the most prolific sack combination of father and son in NFL history, only by one, but they have it, 154 over the Matthews, Clay and Clay, 153, and then Jim and Jackson Jeffcoat at 103.5. But again, he wins back-to-back Super Bowls, 2016, 2017, and I think the most notable for that in his career, at least, is the fact that he brought the first Lombardi Trophy to Philadelphia. But again, this is a guy who off the field is unbelievable. The kinds of things he's done leading humanitarian efforts are really remarkable. His one of his organizations, probably the most prolific one, is called Water Boys. And they have helped to provide more than 200,000 people in Africa with clean water. He and his organization have built nearly 60 water wells in Tanzania. In 2017, there's a guy, I mean, he donated his entire, you probably heard about this, you remember this, he donated his entire salary to educational efforts in Virginia. And then a quarter of his salary last year to help get books into the hands of kids who were in underserved neighborhoods. And it's not a surprise that he got the Walter Payton NFL Man of the Year Award, recognizing a player for his excellence both on and off the field. Just really impressive stuff for Mr. Long.
Number 5.
And if you missed the discussion earlier and if you haven't been paying attention today, really one of the top stories of the day, at least until the Warriors and Blazers tip off tonight, is Magic Johnson. In a no-holds-barred appearance on First Take this morning on ESPN, just not holding back, coming out and saying Rob Pelinka, he's the guy who he was alluding to when he said he was tired of the backstabbing and the whispering that was going on behind his back. A couple of quotes, I'm not going to read it all, but a couple of the quotes that we did read earlier. I start hearing Magic, you're not working hard enough. Magic's not in the office. People around the Lakers office were telling me Rob was saying things, and I didn't like those things being said behind my back, that I wasn't in the office enough. So I started getting calls from my friends outside of basketball saying those things now were said to them outside of basketball now, just not in the Lakers office anymore. And again, part of the straw that he said that broke the camel's back is the whole Luke Walton situation. He didn't like that people on the other side of the organization, and he singled out Tim Harris and others, kept wanting to come to their side of the building, so to speak. It sounds like what the Lakers have right now, more than anything, it just sounds like an absolute disastrous situation relative to ownership, relative to management structure, and there still remains Lakers fans, I mean, diehard Lakers fans who aren't really seeing this clearly, thinking that not having a director of basketball operations, or I should say a president, somebody with a vision, is a good thing. And the parallel that I put on Twitter over the weekend, a comment about that Ramona Shelburne had, and I my comment is, it's like in the restaurant business, where if an owner of a restaurant decided, we don't need an executive, it's a high-end restaurant now, we're not talking about a fast food joint, but a high-end restaurant always has an executive chef, always. He or she sets the menu. They're the ones that set the menu. They're the ones that hire the line cook, the prep cook, the saute cook, and so on, and the sous chef. They're the ones, it's all his or her vision. And the way the Lakers are being run right now, without a director or without a president, excuse me, is it's like a high-end restaurant not having an executive chef in the kitchen and just saying, all of you, all the line, the prep, the saute cook, sous chef, all of you just figure it out and get this thing done. Well, who's the person that's going to set the menu? Because the executive chef is the one who creates the menu. Who's the one that's going to set all the wheels in motion in terms of how stuff gets prepped and when? Who's going to be the one that is organizing how things are expedited in the kitchen? That's just three things out of a list of about a dozen or more. Who's buying product every day? Who's ordering product every day if he is sending all that stuff out? These are the same kinds of things that happen in a basketball organization. And without somebody at the top essentially delegating different things to different people, then it's going to fall to Rob Pelinka. But there's going to be people that are in that organization, and I would suspect saying it now, saying, wait a minute, Rob's a GM. Is it Rob who's in charge, or is it Kurt Rambis? Hold on, wait a minute. Is it Linda Rambis? And without a president, how much power does LeBron James have? And then where does Frank Vogel fit in all this? And what about Jeannie Buss? Is one person in that hierarchy, is she looking at one person more than everybody else? And when you don't have that structure, think of a pyramid. One person at the top of that pyramid, in terms of below the owner, it's you're asking for trouble. So I think the Lakers are asking for trouble. They've already got it on their hands. It's already a situation that's chaotic. And it only has the potential to get worse unless whomever decides to make the call on which way the off season goes starting June 30th at 6 p.m., whether they make a concerted effort to make a trade for Anthony Davis, or whether they try to get a Kyrie, or they try to get Kevin Durant's not going to the Lakers, but they make an effort for him or a Kawhi. This situation in Los Angeles has a chance to go much more quickly from bad to worse. Is that five? Are we done already? How did that happen? I thought we had... Should we do five more? No, let's not do five more. Top five at five.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in about 10 minutes, not quite 10 minutes, more like about 8 or 9, we'll talk to our good friend Nick Petruskevich. We'll talk golf. We're going to talk Brooks Koepka. We will talk Tiger Woods. PGA Championship, also the U.S. Open, which I believe is in, is it July? We'll check that. I'll check that during the pause. I don't mean to go on and on. No, yes, I do. Go on and on about the RPI situation. But I do think that there is a real situation with NCAA selection committees, and I'm not breaking any news here, that they will often tell us that they're spending so much time and effort in the analytics, and they really want to get things right, and the strength of schedule, and who's playing whom, and who's playing better later in the year, and who really has the numbers, and so on. And yet, you look at how softball was selected. You look at the NCAA tournament in basketball, in men's basketball, and to a lesser degree, women's basketball, and you can make the argument that there's always going to be teams that don't get in, because there's a line. You know, you've got 68, you've got 64, you know, 68 in the men's tournament, where you've got the play-in games, but you've got the tournament of 64 in softball, and there's going to be teams that shouldn't get in, or I'm sorry, that aren't going to get in, that you think deserve to get in. But then there are the situations where you have to look at a team or teams that have the requisite numbers. They've got the record. They've beaten the teams that they need to beat, and you can at least make an argument. You can make an argument for one or two or three teams, and let's face it, four teams were not going to get into the NCAA softball tournament from the Mountain West. Colorado State got in, but one more should have gotten in. Take your pick between UNLV, Fresno State, San Diego State. I'm forgetting. Is it Utah State? I'm forgetting now. There were San Jose State. My mistake. San Jose State, UNLV, and Fresno State. Sorry about that. And any one of those three had the record, had the standings, and of the three teams combined, those three teams combined beat Boise State 8 of 9. And yet, it's hard to respect the NCAA when they give us a 2 or 3 or 4 minute reason on why certain teams didn't get in and why some teams did get in, and you're looking at them and you're saying, well, wait a minute now. Hold on a second. Can you run that by me again? Because you lost me there. How did Texas A&M get in again? Let me just get this straight, okay? Okay, because in SEC softball, there are 13 teams, and they came in, let me see, 13th place. And they were three games over 500. They were 28 and 25. You can talk all you want about their, but they're in the SEC. But they were 28 and 25, and they came in last place. And then you say, well, you know what? They're RPI. Yeah, they were only three games above 500, but it's the RPI. Well, no. No, because their RPI, they were lower than both San Jose State and UNLV. They were a few notches higher than Fresno State, maybe more than a few. They sure as heck didn't have the same type of standing in their conference or record. You know, Fresno State was 19 games over 500. And again, I'm not so much taking anything away from Boise State. Hey, they were 21 games over 500. They went to Gainesville, and they played great out there. Credit where credit is due. They went out there and they played great. So what they did was they said, you might have had some questions. Some folks might have had some questions about a fifth place team going out there. But the NCAA might say, you see that? See that? We got that one right. But what, you know, it's the classic what if. What if they go out there and they lose a couple and they're done? We have to backtrack before we get to any of that and say, who should have been the team or teams considered before Boise State, you know, or looking at a Fresno State, UNLV, and San Jose State, and say those three didn't get in, and yet a team with an average to poor RPI, lousy record relative to those three teams, and last place in their conference, they were given a berth. And it goes back to what I say. They simply cannot tell me that they aren't looking at the names or name on a jersey and are influenced by that. I'm sorry. They can't tell me otherwise. They can't tell me that they don't see Texas A&M, Southeastern Conference, and that is more appealing to them. They light up just a little bit more than when they see Fresno State, UNLV, and San Jose State from the Mountain West. And as I say to you so many times, and I'll say it again, I say this not as a Mountain West alum, not as somebody who's from this region. What's fair is fair. And those individuals on that selection committee, they saw Texas A&M, College Station, great facility, great history in the tournament, lots of bids over the years. I think it was their ninth, maybe their eighth or ninth in a row, something like that. They see all of that. This was almost a legacy bid. Now, if they go on and make it to the College World Series, if they go on and I don't know how they did in their regional, because now the super regionals are basically set. So I don't know. Maybe they didn't get out of there. Well, I'm going to look it up during the break. But I'm going to be curious to see if they end up in Oklahoma City. Then hey, hats off to them. Miserable regular season, relatively speaking, but if they step up and do great things, more power to them. All right, one guy who stepped up and was great this weekend, from last Thursday on, Brooks Koepka. We're going to talk about Brooks Koepka, Tiger Woods, the PGA Championship, and U.S. Open with our guy Nick Petruskevich. That's next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Advertising imaginative ways. Start your free trial today. Come on in the water.
All right, so just to update what I was talking about a minute ago, talking about Texas A&M, 28-25. Just a joke that they got into the softball tournament. It was ridiculous. Last place in the SEC, a 50 RPI, and they're already eliminated. Texas eliminated them, so they're done. So that, in some respects, makes the point that I've been making for a week, off and on. And that is that it's just these folks in the selection committee oftentimes are looking more at what is the name of the jersey, what kind of marquee value do they have, versus what's really going on. All right, enough of that. Always fun to have the senior editor from ESPN.com join this program, one of our favorite people, Nick Petruskevich. Mr. Petruskevich, how are you, my friend?
I'm good, but I'm a little nervous. You're fired up.
you know, you're a big-time sports guy, and you know as well as I do that it's maddening, Nick, when you watch NCAA selection committees oftentimes, whatever the sport is, bypass worthy teams in favor of marquee name teams, even if the marquee name team is not remotely in the same class.
My fix for all of this is just to put Joe Lunardi in charge of everything.
Yes, Joe will, Mr. Bracketology, he will fix everything. I like that idea.
Done.
Yes. All right, so the talk going into this weekend, the PGA Championship, or Thursday, was, in many areas, was Tiger, obviously. And we are, of course, in the business of overreaction. Tiger doesn't make the cut. So all I have been hearing in emails and comments to me is, what's wrong with Tiger? Is there cause for concern? What happened to him? I don't see it that way, Nick. And you're the elite golf mind. You'll have to correct me here. I see it as, you know what? He had an amazing win at the Masters. You and I both talked about the fact that there were going to be down tournaments, and it's just no big thing. Moving on to the next one now.
Absolutely. They're like, I got very little right when predicting this tournament, but, I mean, it was a pretty easy prediction to say this was not a good setup for Tiger. He still had the letdown from the Masters. He didn't play a competitive round between the Masters and the PGA. He played a total of 9 holes of practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. He apparently was sick. So this golf course, he isn't 25-year-old Tiger Woods anymore. He's not 35-year-old Tiger Woods anymore. This is a big golf course. It was cold for a few days. It was wet. He's not going to win on a place like this. He's going to win at Augusta. I still believe he's going to be in the mix at Pebble Beach. I believe he'll be in the mix at the Open Championship at Royal Portrush those are the kind of golf courses he can contend on. This week, he had no chance, and to hear him after he was eliminated, after he missed the cut, kind of like, yeah, I'm the Masters champ, so what? That tells you what he thought going into this.
Yeah, that is a great point. One of the things that I like to look at and look at is body language, and listen for is inflection, intonation, because you know as well as anybody, we can learn a lot from where somebody is at by that. And to see the great Tiger Woods just kind of saying, well, I didn't make the cut, and a smile on his face and relaxed and easygoing, I'm not going to say that it was a relief that he didn't have to do two more days on the course, but you know, Nick, it seemed like he was very much at peace with it and very much like, yeah, I'm not really surprised. Let's just move forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, he makes birdie on 18 on Friday and he plays the weekend. But, like, for what? He was never going to catch Brooks Koepka. And so he was just going to kind of put himself through punishment over two more days at Bethpage Black that he didn't need it. It's sort of like the conversation you and I had after the match play when he missed that four-footer that was the best thing that ever happened to him. That four-footer goes in, and he plays another 36 holes the next day. He doesn't win the Masters. I'm standing by that until the ends of the earth. So there was no point for him to be around this weekend. Get back, let the captain drive the yacht back to Florida, get him on a private jet, and we'll see you at Pebble in a month.
Yeah, that's very well put. Nick Petruskevich is our guest, senior editor, ESPN.com, our elite golf mind. You were talking about courses, and this is a big course, and I want to get into that in a second with Brooks Koepka. But what is the kind of course, I mean, as opposed to a big one, are we talking about courses that are a little more narrow in terms of fairways, courses that have more bunkers, more water hazards? Are those the kinds of courses? And you would think that I would know this over the years, but I want to hear it from you. Are those the kinds of maybe shorter courses, but the degree of difficulty is up in terms of the skill level that you have to have with club choice and how you are maneuvering around trees and stuff, that is an area that Tiger tends to excel more?
At this stage of his life, he is more artist than weightlifter. So he needs a golf course in where you have to pick your spots. You have to know what quadrant of the green to be on. You have to know what side of the fairway to be on, which are all things that matter at Augusta, at Pebble, at Royal Portrush. Bethpage is a long, long golf course for professionals. Like, and that we don't, in this day and age of technology and fitness, we don't get this very often, if ever. So I think it's more when he gets to places where it's you have to think your way around the golf course. That is where he has a chance. Bethpage Black's another. It's a monster. And it finally was able to show its teeth on the weekend after being kind of soft and gettable the first 2 days. It's just a big, big, big golf course. People don't understand it, and I think Sunday kind of gave everyone the impression of what this place is without it being tricked up by the USGA. It's just a big, hard golf course.
So that leads me to, of course, Brooks Koepka, who, you know, it looks mm-hmm. like he could be he's got the guns of a baseball player. You know, where the football players don't tend to always look as chiseled as the great hitters do. And he's really got that going for him. And we always hear that he can overpower a course. And he kind of reminds me, if I took it with a basketball parallel, he reminds me of a Kevin Durant in terms of a mix of power and aggressiveness, but the great touch when he needs it. What are the strengths for a Brooks Koepka being able to overpower a course? But is there something is there a weakness in his game that a course not quite like that is going to give him more trouble?
No, I think the easy part of this, and we all probably do it, is to look at the, you know, the half a size too small shirt that shows off the guns and think, like, okay, he's just going to overpower the place. He's just going to hit it farther than everybody, and that's going to be the end of it. But he's got the short game. He can putt. He's got the mental toughness. I think the only thing, and I misread it at the beginning of the week, thinking the pairing with Tiger might not psych him out, but it would put him in a spot where he wanted to do too much, and that would the chip on his shoulder would be too big that he would try to go outside of himself. And that might be the one thing that did happen on Sunday. He was up seven, and he wanted to Tiger the place. He wanted to win by 14. So instead of playing a little bit of defense here and there, he was just firing away. Even when the wind started picking up and the green started to dry out, that's just not him. He was going to go after it. And so if there's one part, it's that chip on his shoulder that I want to step on your throat. Sometimes you got to dial it back, and he might have needed to dial it back at times on Sunday, and he didn't do it, and he let some people back in.
Well, you know, I'm curious about something here. One of the things, and I've been harping on this a lot lately, Nick, is that, and I'm going to go to the NBA again, and I'm going to roll it into golf, is that we are obsessed with talking about what's going to happen starting 6 p.m. on June 30th. We're obsessed with where's KD going, what's happening with Kawhi, Kyrie, and so on. And here we haven't even gotten to the NBA Finals yet. Can we maybe live in the present along with talking about that? Can we just do that for a little while? Well, with Brooks Koepka, we collectively, not everybody, but collectively seem obsessed with trying to figure out, you know, how many majors do you think he's going to win? How many majors will Brooks Koepka win? He's won four, and I like to look back at the Lakers on Christmas night. They were 20-14 after beating the Warriors. They were in the number four playoff position. They were on pace to win 48 games. Then things happened, injuries and so on. Brooks Koepka, we can try to predict, can we not? But there's so many things in golf, seemingly more than team sports, that can happen that maybe he wins another half dozen. Maybe he wins one more.
Right. No, I think that's a completely fair point and a good conversation to have that we're not having. Like, okay, let's step back and not talk about double digits or 15 majors or 18 majors. The guy just won four of the last eight he competed in. Let's just step back and appreciate that instead of trying to figure out what he's going to do next. Because the other part of this, and we had this conversation all weekend, and I think we had it on ESPN.com today, is, listen, we had this conversation with Jordan Spieth a couple years ago where we started throwing around 10, 15, Jack's 18 majors, and he came back to earth. We had it before that. We had it with Rory McIlroy. Hey, maybe 5, 10, 15, 18, and he came back to earth. Like, golf, it's really a simple sentence, but it's true. Golf's hard. So things happen. Things change. There's injuries. There's families. There's whatever else can come about. Let's enjoy four out of eight, because when we get athletes who are elite and who do things that are special, we should appreciate it. What Brooks Koepka has done over the last two calendar years is incredibly impressive. So we can have the argument, because that's what we do, about 10, 15, 18, whatever. But what he's done over the last 2 years is mind-blowing, like history-making. And I think because we want to figure out what's next, we're forgetting what we just saw.
So I want to, folks, we're talking with Nick Petruskevich, senior editor, ESPN.com, regular visitor to this program, and we're thankful for that. I want to take what you just said and maybe jump off the diving board a little bit with it. So what he's done in the past couple of years has been remarkable. But, Nick, are you a better player if you come up big in the majors and nothing else or nearly nothing else, or are you viewed more favorably if the amount of tournaments that you win is excessive, but you only have a couple of majors? How do you bridge that?
He's been asked that question a bunch of, like, okay, you know, you won four of eight. Why aren't you going to win the Travelers or the Memorial or the Waste Management? Like, but me, and we've talked about this, granted, Tiger's won pretty much everything. Like, it's 80 victories, and 81, and he's won everywhere. He's won majors, he's won small events, he's won big events. But the ones that matter, he built his calendar around four times a year, even when he was winning all the other things. If Brooks Koepka wins 15 tour events and 10 of them are majors, like, are we really going to hold against him the fact that he only won 15 times, whereas Dustin Johnson won 30 times on tour, but like one major? I'll take 10 majors and 11 tour wins over 40 wins and one major. So the big things for these guys, and because the money doesn't matter now, they all have so much money, especially at the top of the game. It's the prestige factor. It's the history factor. And you are judged by majors, just like you are judged by rings. So if he wins 10 majors but wins 13 or 14 tour events, I mean, he's going to be an all-time player, even if the regular tour events. I'll take the majors over tour events.
Yeah, I would think so. I want to go back to Bethpage Black for a second. You know, you talked about the course and you explained what a big course it is, and it just beat down just about everybody. So is it just the length, or is there something else about a course like that that really just brings players to their knees?
So there's the length is the biggest. That's the biggest thing there. And there's elevation change. There is, you go into some greens and you've got 180 yards, but it's really 210 because you're going up the hill. Then you throw in some wind. Then you throw in the fact that it has not stopped raining in the Northeast, I think, since January. And so the rough might not be U.S. Open up to your knees, but it is so thick that you saw Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson, who could probably bench press a car, couldn't get out of the rough. Bethpage, I've been pretty lucky. I've played a lot of places. Bethpage Black is the hardest place I've ever played in my life. It is one of those things that you just got to decide, do you want to put yourself through it? It's not fun. It's work.
Yeah.
And again, it's, you know, it's first world problems going to play golf, but like you walk off it and you're like, I'm tired from the swings and I'm tired from the walk, because I talked to Charlie Bowen, who is the head professional at Bethpage Black, before the tournament started. The walking Bethpage Black is 1 mile longer than your average tour stop.
Wow, wow. So is it the kind of course for the person, me, who doesn't play that much golf, but you do? Is it the kind of course, because of everything you laid out, that pin placement doesn't necessarily matter as much as it does in maybe a shorter but more clever course in terms of the kinds of shots that you need to produce?
No, I think the course was set up two different ways. On Sunday, there were pins that were kind of tucked into corners of green. So if you miss it on the wrong side, you're in a bunker. Like, that happens at every course. Bethpage Black's greens are pretty flat. They kept talking about it on the broadcast, and they were right. Like, these players are used to, you know, greens where a putt will break 6 inches, a foot, 2 feet. Sometimes they have their back to the hole. That's not this place. This place, these greens are incredibly flat, and I can't imagine what it would be like if they had gravely contoured greens to put on top of the length and the rough and the bunkers. So the greens there are actually the one place where that lacks defense, because they're actually pretty simple.
You know, there's something that you told me about Augusta National. Just a couple of more things here for you. Nick, you told me about that it's much hillier than a lot of people realize. Okay, that I'm one of those people. I never realized that. And it is because of, you know, as great as TV cameras are, they don't really show that. If you were able to figure out a way that a TV crew could show that, how do you go about showing the kind of topography that is at a place like an Augusta?
I think they're starting to do it a little bit more with the graphics, and I think I saw a couple where it will show you actually how high you go up before you level off. And so, you know, you're going up 30 feet, you're going up 50 feet, I think the better thing would be to show people stories of buildings or something that is more relatable, like, is going up 30 feet. I don't know what that actually means. So if we can make it simpler for people, but I mean, Augusta is incredibly hilly. Like, there are a few even if you're in good shape, take your breath away walks uphill. There are a couple at Bethpage that are like that. The walk between the 17th green and the 18th tee, like, you got to lean into that hill to get up there. And there's probably six or seven holes at Bethpage Black that are like that. So it's a long walk. And so when you have John Daly in a cart and people question whether the walking part matters, the walking part matters. Like, it's part of the challenge.
You're absolutely right. There's no question about it. I think about, it's been a while since I've done 18 holes. And again, I'm not very good, but I was exhausted. I was absolutely exhausted. So I just imagine what it's like when you are coming back from an injury or you have a chronic back. situation. It's got to be brutal. The physical toll on golfers. We don't really. It used to be something that people joked about, but now people, you know, in terms of when we learn so much more about what an injury does to a person in a sport, we don't really laugh about that anymore. Last thing for you. U.S. Opens at Pebble. Can't wait for that. I'm hoping that I can actually meet you in person. Should we expect a better showing for a Tiger Woods?
Absolutely. I think this is a perfect place for him. I think it's a perfect place for Phil Mickelson. This is one of those golf courses. That Paige Black eliminated half the field the minute some of these guys put the tee in the ground. Like Zach Johnson has no shot at Bethpage Black. Kevin Kisner has no shot at Bethpage Black. Everybody who puts the tee in the ground that's a professional golfer, a regular on the tour in the top 100 or top 75 has a shot at Pebble because it's going to be playing right around between 68 and 7,100 yards, which is a normal tour size. And it's going to be about shot making. It's going to be about putts. The greens are incredibly small, so it's going to be about precision. There are a lot of people that are going to be in contention, and this course is a perfect, perfect setup for Tiger. He can play irons. He can play shots high. He can play shots low. It's going to be creativity, which at this part of his life, he was great at it before. He has to be great at it now because there are other players who hit it farther than him, so he can't overpower the place. But in his mind's eye, just like at Augusta, he knows how to get around Pebble. He's won there on a regular tour stop. He's won there when the U.S. Open has been there because 2000 was the one time in the history of this sport where a human being beat the sport. Nobody beats golf. In 2000, Tiger Woods beat golf at Pebble Beach.
Folks, he is Nick Petruskevich. Love having him on the program. We will be talking to him certainly when the U.S. Open rolls around. Well, sorry, before that. We'll be talking to him before that. Nick, always a great pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your early evening out on the East Coast to join us.
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right, absolutely. One more thing is next. This is the CGP. Another one in the books. Great to have all of you aboard today. And, again, thanks for all your birthday greetings. I do appreciate that. My thanks to Tony D., Paul Leffler, Nick Petruskevich, my man Russ doing his usual great job. And, as I said, all of you. Folks, we will see you in 21 hours. Until then, you're on your own.